I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Have you seen Black Panther? Well, if so, you are not alone. It's closing in on $900 million at the box office worldwide, and it could pass the billion-dollar mark soon. That's more than Wonder Woman and Spider-Man, and it's catching up fast to Batman. But its significance extends far past its celebrated status in the panoply of superhero movies. For black children and their parents, it's the rare chance to root for heroes who look like them and an opportunity to see black culture and achievement depicted as the most advanced and admired in the world. On this edition of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks, we're joined by Dr. Stanford Carpenter, a cultural anthropologist and comic book creator. The cultural importance of the Black Panther. That's coming up right after the news. And good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Indeed, it is midday. Thanks for being with us. Jordan Peele made history on Sunday night as the first African-American to win the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. The writer and director won the award for his horror film Get Out, which had also garnered nominations for Best Director and Best Picture. The protagonist in the film was a young black man played by Daniel Kaluuya, a rarity in the horror genre. Praising fellow black directors in his post-Oscar interview, Peele took note of this pivotal moment in time where black excellence in film is being recognized in every genre, and black artists are enjoying mainstream success behind the camera as well as on the screen in roles crafted to speak to the entirety of the black experience throughout the African diaspora. Perhaps no film embodies that truth more so than Black Panther. The latest offering from the Marvel Cinematic Universe has been smashing box office records around the world and thus far has grossed nearly $900 million worldwide. From problematic caricatures steeped in racist stereotypes for the consumption of white audiences to King T'Challa, the billion-dollar box office powerhouse, it appears we are seeing an important evolution of black comic book characters. Today on Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks, we reflect on the history of race, representation, and inclusivity in the world of comics and how Black Panther has flipped the script on feminism in film. Sherry Parks is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman, and she joins us every month for Culture Connections. Good to see you, Sherry.
Hi there.
And from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago, Dr. Stanford Carpenter joins us. He's a cultural anthropologist and comic book creator. He is a scholar of comic books. He serves on the board of the annual Black Comic Arts Festival and Pocket Con, a convention that focuses on comics for young boys and girls of color. Dr. Carpenter, thank you for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, what did you think of Black Panther? And do you see it as a turning point for the way black characters and black culture are depicted in mainstream Hollywood movies? You are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can find us on Twitter at @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming today live on Facebook at the WYPR Facebook page. So, we need to begin, first of all, with a spoiler alert. If you have not seen Black Panther, we're going to talk about it, and we're going to probably talk a bit about the plot and stuff. So if you don't want to know what happens in the movie before you see it, you should meditate instead of listening to Midday today. But Sherry Parks, you've seen it. What'd you think? I saw it. I thought it was terrific, just in general, as a movie. But what were your reactions, both as a moviegoer and as a scholar?
Well, you know, they exist in the same body, so it's hard to pull them apart. But and I'm not, unlike Stanford, I'm not a huge fan of the action genre. You'll hear his enthusiasm in a minute. We're old friends. I enjoyed it very much, and the production values are really high. There's lots of nuance and little things to pick up so that I remained entertained. The message is one that I thought was important. So, I mean, it has this share of car chases and things like that, but there's a lot going on. There are ideas at work here. And so, and the representations, particularly of black women, were varied and strong and important, and I liked it.
Yeah. And Dr. Carpenter, one of the things that was fascinating to me as I looked into this with our producer, Sienna Greaves, the publication timeline for Black Panther. Black Panther was a character that appeared a long time ago. This is not a new thing, is it?
No, it's not. And it's a character that's gone through multiple evolutions to get to the Black Panther that we see on film. A lot of people, and I find this interesting, when people comment on the film, they talk about it as if Black Panther has been steadily published in the way that he appears, when that's really not the case. The Black Panther we have is based very much on some specific storylines. But yeah, it's an evolutionary process, not a revolutionary one.
And it debuted in 1966. I mean, the very first one was 1966, and as you say, it's evolved and changed a lot. But you know, Sherry Park's The Black Panther Party was established by Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, in October of 1966. I mean, the creation of this character happened concurrently. That's fascinating.
Well, and the interesting thing
wasn't.
The interesting thing about comics is that a lot of people don't pay them a lot of attention, but a lot of things go on in comics. And there's a lot of literary talk back in the letters when comic books were largely in the older form. And so lots of what you would consider revolutionary ideas happen in comics. But I think Stanford was about to pull those two ideas apart, too.
Yeah.
Kind of. What's interesting is that the Black Panther comic was actually published before the Black Panther Party really came out, and it was and the actual comic was created like 2 to 3 months before it was published. And actually, what happened is in the early 70s, there was an attempt by Marvel to distance Black Panther from the Black Panther Party by changing his name to the Black Leopard, and we know how well that worked out.
Yeah, interesting.
What does that even mean, though, yeah. Black Leopard?
Well, the original character designs for him were not the original character designs. He was going by the Cole Tiger, which makes even less sense for an African character. And then he became the Black Panther. But even if you look at the original storyline where he's introduced, it's a Fantastic Four story where. In my interview with Stan Lee, he was telling me about it, where essentially they were just trying to do sort of a standard Fantastic Four story where they go and discover some hidden civilization, and they wanted to have an O. Henry ending, and the O. Henry ending was going to be that they find out that this primitive civilization is actually incredibly advanced. And then Jack Kirby came in and was like, hey, going along the lines of trying to do more characters that look like the people outside of Marvel's offices, they said, well, why don't we make them black? And then they decided to set it in Africa.
Yeah.
So it just as easy, we just as easy could be talking about the brown puma coming out of South America as the Black Panther coming out of Africa.
And Sherry Parks, I mean, in terms of representation, both of Africans and African Americans, what was your reaction? What struck you in terms of this movie, Black Panther, as a film? How people in Africa, the culture of Africa, were depicted, and how because there have been people who've raised some questions about the Americans in this movie and how they were depicted. What were your thoughts?
Well, the Americans do come in at certain points that make it, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in terms of who helps to save the day. But I think many people think of this image of Africa as highly advanced is as imaginary, and it's actually historical, as Europe was pulling itself out of what we perhaps in this case, ironically called the Dark Ages. Africa actually was very advanced, and the first universities and calculus and things like that were being developed, and people were traveling from Europe to parts of North Africa, particularly, but not only North Africa, to learn things. And so that idea, which seems very foreign to mainstream audiences, is actually historically based. But the images in there, you can tell that there were black hands in there. I'm not saying that every image of a black person has to be by a black person, but the level of nuance that was there, and the depiction and the story of, the moral dilemma is that the country was so wealthy and yet it had not helped anybody. And over again, they say people like us are suffering. And that idea of needing to help other black people is very, one, very much a part of the traditional black culture, but also an interesting message for a mainstream film that's doing as well as it is doing.
Yeah. And Dr. Carpenter, was the Black Panther, when it was introduced in the 60s and then, you know, evolved over time, was it the only black character in comics? You are literally a scholar of the comic book, of the history of comic books and characters. Was Black Panther a singular figure, or was he one of a few?
He was, I would characterize him as one of a few. I mean, he was a first in terms of the first mainstream black superhero. You know, and that by mainstream, I mean coming out of Marvel or DC Comics, which account for most of the sales. There had been some instances of some black superheroes. For instance, there was a black superhero in All Negro Comics, which was put out, you know, decades beforehand. But for a while, Black Panther was singular. But Marvel brought in other black characters, you know, in the wake of Black Panther over the years. You know, they brought in the Falcon, which is the first African American superhero in the Marvel universe. DC created a Black Green Lantern. They created Black Lightning, which is a character that has his own television show right now. So there's always been a number of black characters, but as my daughter put it, especially back then, they were more sprinkled in. They weren't a critical mass in any way, manner, or form.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes they change race, right?
Yes.
Oh, give me an example of that. They change it. I mean, you're talking about the Green Lantern all of a sudden becoming black. Is that what you're talking about, or what are you talking about?
Well, there's this concept in comics called legacy characters, where essentially someone else picks up the mantle, or they reboot a character. They reboot a character in such a way where it's like, oh, now we have, you know, like with Mr. Terrific, one of my favorite DC characters, was originally a white character created in the 40s. He's wealthy and he's so bored that he's considering suicide. So instead, he goes out and fights crime. Then later on, they come back and they reimagine the character, and it's an African American who takes on the mantle, and now he's actually got his own comic in the DC universe, in the DC Comics universe. Well, so this does happen.
Well, and I think one of the things you were asking questions about diversity, something that certainly happens in comics is that people change appearance a lot. And I think that is related.
Yeah, they morph into stuff.
And comic book readers are used to appearances changing, and that signals something. But they're used to a lot of diversity of looks. But I also want to circle back to, you seemed a little surprised that Stanford Carpenter was a professor of comics. And that actually is an established field. It's a fairly new field, but he's one of the leading ones, but he's not the only. There actually are a number of people who study comic books. They have conventions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I think it's, as you say, it's an important thing. I mean, there are things that appear in comics that, you know, just sort of, you know, merge into the culture in ways that if you're not a comic book reader, you know, you may not notice.
And that's an important point, that they often happen in comic books first, and that comic book audiences often lead film audiences, and that they will comment on whether or not the film character is right or not, or whether the film fits with the back history. When Halle Berry was Storm, actually, she commented on it, that it was the comic book people who came back to her and said, "You're not strong enough." I actually think that was Angela Bassett's role. And then she said, "I'm trying to be stronger in the next movie." She didn't do it. But that idea that other audiences pay attention and actors pay attention to what comic book readers with this huge backlog, because it's not unusual to have somebody who is has read comic books for 20 years. I mean, maybe all of their adult life is even longer. And so they're an important audience.
And that also ties into the difficulty of making a superhero film. I mean, we take for granted the success of superhero films with what, in part because of the success that Marvel has had. But if you look through the 80s and the 90s, I mean, there are so many attempts to make superhero films that fall flat on their face. And part of it is that it's very simple that, like, if the comic book readers don't like a character, they won't buy enough tickets to make a movie sales figures. But if they badmouth the character to all their friends who are not comics readers, the general audience is, you know, tend not to show up.
Sure. This is really a lot of fun to talk about this because I mean, the movie was a singular experience for me as a white guy sitting in a theater that was, you know, largely populated by black families. I also had a wonderful interaction with a little 10-year-old kid, a 10-year-old black boy who was wearing his Superman sweatshirt, and his 6-year-old daughter, and they were just like jumping out of their shoes in the popcorn line waiting to see it. They just heard so much about it, and so it just did really speak to me as an important cultural moment for African-American families.
That's really important. I hope we circle back
and
to it.
We will indeed circle back when we take a little break. Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland is the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Dr. Stanford Carpenter is a cultural anthropologist and a scholar and creator of comics. We'll have more on the cultural implications of Black Panther when we return. 410-662-8780. If you'd like to join our conversation, our email midday@wypr.org. You can follow us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. We are also streaming live this afternoon on the WYPR Facebook page. Back in a flash, here's some music from Kendrick Lamar, who wrote and produced the soundtrack for Black Panther.
What do you stand for? Are you an activist? What are your city plans for? Are you an accident? Are you just in the way? Your native tongue contradicting what your body language say? Are you a king? Are you joking? Are you a king? Are you posing? Are you a king? Are you smoking bull rocks to keep you open? Because a king don't cry, king don't die, king don't like king. If all king get by kingdom, for kingdom come when I come, you know why.
King. I am T'Challa.
And good afternoon again. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, WYPR's digital producer Jamila Krimple will be filling in for me, and I'm grateful to her for that. She'll lead a discussion about how Baltimore is perceived in both local and national media and how those perceptions affect the everyday reality of Baltimore residents. Jamila's guests will be Lisa Snowden McRae, the editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Beat, although we just learned minutes ago that the Baltimore Beat is perhaps ceasing publication. Lawrence Lanahan, the former producer of The Lines Between Us, will be with Jamila as well. And Al Hutchinson, the president and CEO of Visit Baltimore. So I hope you can join Jamila Krimple and her guests tomorrow right here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we are all geeking out on all things Black Panther and talking about the evolution of the black superhero. Sherry Parks is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park. Her book is called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. And Dr. Stanford Carpenter joins us from Chicago. He's a comic book creator and a cultural anthropologist who studies comics closely. You are welcome to be part of our conversation. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Find us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR. And we are broadcasting, streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Dr. Carpenter, I understand that you've seen this movie 3 times with 3 different audiences. So tell us about the 3 audiences and how their reactions differed or were similar.
Okay, well, the first one was, it was a local event where a local comic shop bought out a movie theater to do a showing. They set it up where, it's called First Aid Comics. They had all sorts of door prizes, special packages. They actually had it set up where your ticket was actually issue number 4 of Black Panther. So it literally ended up being a theater full of primarily black comic book fans. The second time that I saw it was it was at a more of a mainstream Metroplex, and it was with my 12-year-old daughter. And she'd really been looking forward to it. In fact, when we saw the initial advertisements, she had looked up at me and she was like, "Daddy, do you think that maybe they'll have a white villain that they go up against?"
She called that one right.
I mean, she was just like, you know, and for her it's been interesting because she's at that age where she's really coming into her identity, and so she's expressing a lot of it through the different black superheroes and media. The third time I saw it was at was in San Antonio as part of the Planet Deep South conference. And what they did was they bought out a movie theater called the Alamo, and they had it was mostly college students, probably with a large percentage of them being college students of color and faculty members. And in that one, as the one at the first one at Harper Court, I led a panel discussion after the movie.
And what did you hear? I mean, did you hear anything that surprised you? Did you hear things that, was your daughter, did your daughter react to the movie the same way that the college kids and the college professors did, for example?
No. I mean, so in order, I mean, what was interesting, the one at Harper Court where it was mostly comic fans, I was, you know,
and that's in Chicago. That's in Chicago.
That's in Chicago.
We should tell folks.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yep, no problem.
Yeah, Harper Court in Chicago. And First Aid Comics in Chicago. I was surprised because when I watched it, I immediately latched onto Killmonger's character, and it wasn't so much as a ringing endorsement. But when I looked at Killmonger's character, I was thinking to myself, "Who does this remind me of? Who does this remind me of?" And I realized it was the spook who sat by the door. Mm-hmm. And then when I got up, one of the people I was sitting next to said, well, you probably shouldn't bring that up because people want to be excited about the movie, and that might be kind of a downer to start talking about Eric Killmonger's character. And the first comment I got from the audience was the surprise over feeling like they related more to Killmonger than they did to Black Panther.
And we should remind folks that The Spook Who Sat by the Door is a book that came out in 1969 by a guy named Sam Greenlee, and it's the story of the first black CIA officer and the history of training persons in political groups who then use their special training, like Killmonger does in this movie, to effect nefarious purposes. Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, do it. Armed revolution to take over the United States. And he funnels it through gang members, mm-hmm. which is where I see the really interesting parallel, right? I mean, he doesn't just take over Wakanda. He's got his distribution system already set up, that being using the Wakandan war dogs, who are placed in cities all over the world to distribute the weapons. So it's very tactical. But it was interesting hearing the comic fans talk about it, especially with the knowledge of the characters. The other thing that was that they picked up on were they were surprised that M'Baku's character, who in the comics goes by the name Man-Ape and basically is wearing a gorilla outfit, they were surprised that they were able to actually turn that character into a character that they enjoyed. There's a lot more geekery in that particular viewing. In the viewing with my daughter, I mean, she was just riveted because we were at a place with reclining seats and everything. So she reclined her seat, she sat cross-legged, and she had her food in front of her, and she was just leaning forward just into it. And she came out of it just talking, you know, she couldn't stop talking about the female characters that were in there. She couldn't stop talking about Shuri. She couldn't stop talking about Okoye. And for me, I was glad as a father to be there in a space where there are heroic characters for my daughter.
Of course. And of course, you know, Sherry Parks, one of the things that struck me about this movie, and Linnell and Miranda and her girlfriend, we all saw it together, is these are the best looking people I've ever seen on any movie. I mean, the women are gorgeous. The men are handsome as can be. Everybody's just ripped and gorgeous to look at. I mean,
and there are different ways of being beautiful. I mean, there's not just one look. Everybody in the movie doesn't look like Beyonce.
Right.
And so they're different colors and shapes and they're shot, which is partly lighting. I mean, it's easy to make black people look gray on film if you don't know how to light them. And HBO, that was one of the things that The Wire, for instance, did is light people in a way. And so that idea of black beauty, which may seem a little superfluous, is really, really important. And Stanford's talking about his daughter, the idea that there are images of black women who are physically strong. They are the major warriors.
Yeah, they get the spears and they go at it.
Right,
yeah.
And they say, you know, you are the best warrior we have. And she's pointing to another woman. And she's beautiful, and she's complaining. At one point, she has to put on a wig, and she's, you know, there's this nonsense on my head. And so they often...
She ends up using the wig as a weapon. I thought that was great.
Yeah, it's the best use of wig in a film. So, I mean, so they do a lot to reinforce black modes of beauty, which is really important.
Yeah.
But I think it's also significant to talk about hair in this movie. Mm-hmm. I saw pretty much almost, you know, in this movie, you saw just a cacophony of styles of black hair, right? And you even saw beauty in black women with no hair, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, especially in a culture where black hair is something, at least in African American communities, we talk a lot about hair.
Sure.
You know,
and you're right. These bald women were just absolutely stunning. I mean, partially because of what they were wearing, but also how they held themselves, their countenance, and their incredible skill.
And no weaves.
Right. No weaves. Right.
But also contrast it with the Amazons in Wonder Woman. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, so you've got, you know, I mean, one of the issues in Wonder Woman, and then from Wonder Woman to Justice League, there was a big row on Facebook and social media about how the Amazons from Wonder Woman lost a lot of their clothes when they went to when they appeared in Justice League, right? they went from scanty armor to literally scanty bathing suits. And then if you look at the Dora Milaje in Black Panther, I mean, they are, for the most part, they're dressed from head to toe, except for the scenes when they're in the water, right? So there's a certain, so the beauty is not tied to being scantily clad and showing flesh as well.
Here's an interesting comment from a listener, Deborah, who writes on email, why does the name have to reference color at all? You have the likes of Thor, Aquaman, Captain America, Batman, Superman, and when the hero is African, now it's black something or other. Why is that? Is that significant, Sherry Parks?
Well, I mean, certainly when it was introduced, it was rare. And there is a thing in language: when something is different, you signal it, and when something is more common, you don't signal it. And so it is important. But the term Black Panther has currency outside of comics. I mean, it's a common usage of the term. I mean, because panther is actually kind of a generic term. You know, mountain lions and other things are, but a black panther is black. All panthers, all things that are called panthers, are not necessarily black, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so. And Stanford Carpenter, when it comes to Eric, the character of Eric Killmonger, there are people like Jelani Cobb, Columbia University, and a columnist for The New Yorker, who says that this movie offers what he calls a redemptive counter-mythology. But then there's a guy who was writing in The Post, a man named Patrick Gathara, who is a writer and a political cartoonist in Kenya, and says that this is a vision of Africa and African-Americans, I suppose, that could only spring from a neo-colonial mind. What's your response to that point of view?
Well, that's the thing. That is one of the things that's interesting about these kinds of narratives is I don't think it's either or. I think they're both true. And I know that might sound like I'm hedging, but that is what, especially in comics and with comic characters, that they usually try to do. They try to create narratives that can be read in different ways so that you can attract larger audiences. You know, there's a lot of appeal to the narrative that is seen as sort of a narrative between Africa and, or you know, the Africa and the African diaspora in terms of who you help and what constitutes we, right? But to say that there's no colonial elements to it, in some ways, you know, there's no way that you can really get around that. And at a certain point, you are talking about something that takes place in Africa and accepts the history of colonialism in Africa, right? And they have to somehow fit Wakanda into that. You know, they do it to some degree by making Africa, or not making Wakanda, a hidden kingdom, right? But then once you have a hidden kingdom in there, then that raises that actually reinscribes a whole bunch of other critiques, right? Yeah. So yeah, I think that's one of the things that the movie did that was successful. It's also built into the character. I mean, if you look at Black Panther, he's designed to be incredibly noble. The original Black Panther was basically Sidney Poitier with a mask, right? Yet they're still in the movie able to construct these moments where he's unapologetically black, which right then and there widens your audience, right? The people who want to see nobility are going to see the nobility, and then there are other people who are going to be cheering for those moments of unapologetic blackness.
Sherry.
And there are these political moments. There's a moment where the white American who's in there is called a colonizer, and so that message is there. And I think the idea that in order for Wakanda to keep its mineral riches, they had to go underground speaks to what happened in Africa, and that in order to keep their riches, they had to hide because
colonizer the white people and others could steal the resources.
Well, and certainly that happened with gold and diamonds and lots of things. The other thing is that at the very beginning of the movie, it starts in a museum, and the message is made very clear that these artifacts were stolen from African and other countries. I mean, they actually kind of do almost this catalog of country of origin. And actually, Killmonger says, well, you stole it from Benin, but he doesn't, that's not quite a quote, but you took it from Benin, but it really came from Wakanda. So I think, yes, this isn't completely fantastical. It really does, if it happens. And Stan Lee's comics tend to do that. They tend to take some realistic elements and keep them in there. It's hard to talk about Africa without talking about colonialism because, as Stanford said, it is there. It still is there.
Yeah, and Dr. Carpenter, on this notion of how revolution and revolutionaries are depicted, Killmonger is a revolutionary, and folks have made various scholars and whatnot have commented and observed that revolutions don't happen without violence. Civil wars and wars of any kind are inherently violent, and Killmonger was not shy about using violence for the ends that he wanted to do. He very much disagreed essentially with the foreign policy of Wakanda. He didn't want to hide under a forest where no one could see them. He wanted to get out and change the world and revolutionize the world. But he is interestingly, the African American character from Oakland. That's how we're introduced to him, the violent revolutionist. What do you make of that?
Well, and that's where the spook who sat by the door comparisons come in. There are several moments where Killmonger harkens back to one of the last lines in the spook who sat by the door, which is, they've started the revolution, and the lead character who has turned gangs all across the country into revolutionary resistance cells. He kills his best friend, who is a detective. And everyone and some of the other people who are working with him with the revolution look at him and they're like, whoa, you killed your best friend. He's like, I'm just paraphrasing, he essentially says, well, this is how it goes in a revolution. You see, you're probably going to have to kill your brother, your sister, your mom, your uncle, because anybody who's on the other side of the ideological line needs to be eliminated. And I think that's something that they embrace with Killmonger's character, where he's just like, yeah, if you're in the way, this is my revolution. Revolutions are ugly. I mean, people say that civil wars are ugly, but you can have a civil war without a revolution, but you can't have a revolution without a civil war. And so that to me is what makes that character very interesting. At the same time, there are also quite a few people out there who expressed concerns that they feel that the character is misogynistic in terms of his treatment of women.
Mm-hmm. Sherry Parks, a quick thought before we take a break.
And I was going to say there's another interesting moment where two people who had been lovers find themselves on opposite sides. And the man says, would you kill me? Would you really kill me? And the woman warrior says, for my country, yes. And so that message of sometimes in this film,
of where the loyalties lie.
Right. And that you're willing to kill in order to advance either your loyalty to the crown or the revolution.
Mm-hmm. One quick comment before we take a break from our producer, Sienna Greaves, who says, piggybacking off of your comment, Sherry, that Issa Rae has been hailed for the use of lighting to highlight and extenuate the complexion of the characters in her show, Insecure. So you're right that, you know, you mentioned The Wire, people are even, like, the technical depiction is in many ways just as prevalent and important as the philosophical depiction of characters.
As anybody who's tried to get holiday pictures taken of their Black family.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We will come back. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. You can find us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR. We'll have more of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks and our guest, Dr. Stanford Carpenter, when we come back. We'll be here in 90 seconds. Stick around. And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us here on Midday. It's Midday Culture Connections today with Dr. Sherry Parks. If you're just joining us, we're talking about feminism, race, and representation in comics in the context of Black Panther's record-breaking run in movie theaters worldwide. Sherry and I are joined by cultural anthropologist and superhero scholar, Dr. Stanford Carpenter, who joins us on the line from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. You're welcome to join us as well, 410-662-8780. That's our number here on Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to find us in the Twittersphere @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming live on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Sherry, I want to ask you about a group of scholars. You talk about how the study of comics is, in fact, very legit and widespread, or somewhat widespread, scholarly endeavor. You are actually a member of a group of you and a number of scholars, and is Dr. Carpenter as well?
He started it.
You started. Okay. Well, then let me ask you first, and then Stanford Carpenter, I'll ask you to correct the record. But it's called Critical Front, and you and a bunch of other Black scholars, including folks like Lester Spence, whom a lot of folks know here in Baltimore. He's a scholar at Hopkins. I mean, I understand he's part of it.
It was Ben Vinson when he was at.
Right. Someone told me Lester Spence. But this is a group. You've actually done performances.
Yes.
So what's this about?
Well, and that's why I chuckled when you said superhero scholar, because you meant he studies superheroes, but I wrote it down as superhero/scholar, Stanford Carpenter.
I don't know. Why is it slash? I mean, you strike me as
because he's both. Because he is both. And the idea, and it was Stanford's idea, but I'll go ahead and start it, and he certainly can finish it, is that we are all academics. They are academics of note and bigger names than me, Patricia Williams and John Jackson. And these are in the academic fields, giants. John Jackson is the new dean of the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania. And all of us have things that we want to say that we cannot say in our academic lives, or they're outrageous. And so Stanford came up with the idea of making us superheroes. And actually, you mentioned Fierce Angel. The name, the character Fierce Angel, precedes the book. And Stanford was drawing, he was working with each of us to draw ourselves. And he said, "Sure, you got to come up with a name. And generically, I think he started calling it Fierce Angel. And then I said, "I kind of like that." And he said, I'm glad. I kind of like that too. And then when it came time for the book, it became
there. It is. It's in the title.
Yeah. My superpowers. We all have superpowers, and I can fly. Of course, I have to fly. But I hear from the mother, so I always know what's going on. Because in Faust, when he says we're going to the mothers, no, not the mothers. I hear from the mothers, and they always tell me, so I know what you're thinking, and I know what's going on in the next room because the mothers are telling me.
Uh-huh. And Stanford Carpenter, what's your superhero power or your superpower?
Well, my character's brother story. And the idea behind him is that he thinks he's dying. And in order to cheat death, he creates a deal with an Auntie the Spider. And essentially, he comes out of that with the task of collecting stories for an Auntie the Spider, because an Auntie the Spider owns folktales which are in the public domain. And what's happened over time is the public domain has been shrinking. So Anansi's starving for stories. He later does find out that he was never dying and it was all a trick by Anansi. But
and Anansi is an established character in African folktales and folklore. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah,
interesting. Correct. Yeah, he's a trickster figure, and so his powers. I mean, he doesn't have the traditional superpowers like flight or anything like that. But what it is that he's heard so many stories that he can predict things that are about to happen, and he's got this uncanny ability to fade into the background and not be noticed. He doesn't turn invisible. It's just that nobody notices him as he's collecting stories, and he moves from space to space and creates connections that otherwise wouldn't be created.
And of course, there's a tie between being an anthropologist and being a superhero who collects stories.
Yeah,
exactly.
And you guys actually did live performances. I mean,
yes.
Shows.
Yeah, I mean, we got together and wrote scripts, and Stanford drew graphics, and so we would stand on stage, not in costume, but behind us, our superheroes were in full costume and doing things.
All right.
And we were. I will brag because Stanford made this happen. Artist in Residence at the Chicago Institute of Art.
So Stanford, why did the band break up? this is as sorry a day as the Beatles no longer performing together. My gosh.
Well, they may return. You never know.
the band never breaks up. We just go on solo missions.
Yes, yeah, you're doing solo projects.
Well, that's true. I mean, that different people are using different.
Look, Batman's got his own. Batman's got his own book, and he's in the Justice League. So,
yeah, that's right. He's joining bands instead of doing his own. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. We're streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stanford Carpenter joins us from Chicago. Dr. Sherry Parks joins us right here in Studio A. Here's an email from Tanya, before we get too far ahead of ourselves predicting changes in Hollywood films, let's remember The Last Emperor in 1987, which was supposed to usher in the age of Asian actors. Try to find John Lone or Joan Chen, let alone more Asian actors. Interesting. I mean, I was talking to Jed Dietz and Max Weiss about this last Thursday, a few days before the Oscars, and Jed said, okay, that conversation's over. Now everybody knows that black films can make a whole lot of money, so we don't have to worry about these white studio executives, dismissing the projects that black directors bring to them of black stories. What do you think?
Well, there actually was less terrain to take over with black characters versus Asian characters. I mean, it's not a good thing, but in many years, according to the studies, you will find more extraterrestrials in American media than you will find Asians. And African Americans occupy a space in the American public imaginary that just isn't there. That's why in some ways African Americans have been overrepresented. I mean, people come to the United States and think there are lots and lots of African Americans. There was another example. It's hard to think back to this about Bill Cosby, but there was that same truism about advertising. And do you remember Pudding Pops? And they ran an ad. He convinced them to do Pudding Pops, and it was a huge hit. And once that barrier was broken, it was broken for lots of other people. African Americans also traditionally push for media images in ways that Asians have not. And so there's this momentum and a push and a lot of people in the industry. So that this momentum will probably have more traction.
And Dr. Carpenter, you've written about the fact that there were black and racial and ethnic characters in circulation in advertising and whatnot, but they were based on really negative stereotypes.
Yes, that's true. And I mean, but I'd like to go back to the comment about this being the moment where this being a moment for seeing the power of black films, right? But I know this sounds cynical, but we've been here before. It was called the Blaxploitation Era, a time when, when Hollywood
70s,
was having trouble. Right. And, the Blaxploitation films came out that were made by, that had black actors and then black people behind the cameras. And then it shifted to black people in front of the cameras and then white people behind the cameras. And then after that, you have, white action heroes, taking over. I'm not saying that I think that this is not an important moment, but I'm always a little bit guarded when we when we jump to saying, oh, this is a first and it's going to be a complete game changer. It's going to be a game changer if we're able to sustain it.
Well, and I don't think anybody's suggesting it's a complete game changer, but the difference between black exploitation and now is that a lot of those films, I mean, and they enjoy broad viewership now, but when they first hit the theaters, they were playing to predominantly black audiences. They didn't necessarily cross over in the first run theater, and that is the difference.
We have a email from Lisa, who says, I love the comparison between Black Panther and Wonder Woman's very different depictions of women. In particular, I love that the women in Black Panther had natural underarms. I was quite frankly surprised when the women in Wonder Woman's Secret Untouched Island had laser smooth underarms.
So, I noticed that.
I did not notice that.
I noticed that. When one of them raised their arms, there was hair, which, you know.
And that's a good thing.
Well, It's a cultural thing. It's something that African and African-American women have not traditionally done. Most African-American women do it now as a type of acculturation. But then certainly people who move back and forth, either in ancient areas or move back and forth, as Wakanda does, wouldn't necessarily be shaving their underarms.
And Dr. Carpenter, we have an email here from Bobby who says, a particularly poignant commentary on current issues was in the post-credits extra scene where T'Challa is speaking to the UN to say that Wakanda will share its tech and culture with the rest of the world. He says, in times of conflict, the wise build bridges, the foolish build barriers. And it brings up this bifurcation between people who consider themselves Afrofuturists versus Afro-pessimists. Talk a little bit about that. We just have a minute or so left.
Well, you know, Black Panther definitely falls in the realm of Afrofuturism. I mean, you've got Wakanda, which is basically a utopia, right? And it's a technological utopia. It both looks forward and backward at the same time. And I think it's interesting. And for me, the interesting contrast is you've got this movie that is very much an Afrofuturist film. But currently, the person who's doing Black Panther is Ta-Nehisi Coates, right?
He's writing it currently. Yeah,
they're writing it. Yes, mm-hmm. he's the current writer, but he's also overseeing some of the other Black Panther, you know, comics that feature Black Panther as well. So there is a really interesting contrast there in terms of the approaches to Wakanda. In the comics, they're doing a lot about sort of like breaking down Wakanda, looking at like at these hidden histories of Wakanda. Was Wakanda a colonial power in some way? Whereas in the film, It just takes for granted that Wakanda, there was one big fight, everybody got together, and they formed their country, and they moved forward and decided to be all they could be with these amazing resources that they had.
Dr. Stanford Carpenter is a cultural anthropologist and comic book creator. He is a scholar of comic books. He serves on the board of the Black Comic Arts Festival and PocketCon. That's a convention that focuses on comics for young boys and girls of color. Dr. Carpenter, thank you so much for your time. It's really been great talking to you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. And she joins me on the first Tuesday of the month for Midday Culture Connections. Thanks so much, Sherry. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, our digital producer, Jamila Krempel, is sitting in for me for a conversation about how Baltimore is portrayed in the media and how that affects perceptions and the economic health of our city. Jamila's guests will be Lisa Snowden McCray of the Baltimore Beat, and Jamila will talk to Lisa about the current status of the Baltimore Beat. We learned this morning that the publisher has decided to cease publication, so Jamila will ask Lisa about that tomorrow. She'll also be joined by Lawrence Lanahan. He's the former producer of The Lines Between Us. That's an award-winning series that occurred during Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast back in the day. And Al Hutchinson, the president and CEO of Visit Baltimore, will also join Jamila. So I hope you can join all of them tomorrow right here on Midday. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Out of the Blocks is coming up next after a break for news at the top of the hour. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.